Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Phil Dierking, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Phil Dierking.
A new study of mice suggests bacteria may help to cause anxiety and depression in overweight people. The research raises questions about whether changing organisms living inside our bodies or changes in diet could help treat these conditions. A 2017 study found that one-third of the world's population is overweight or considered obese. When people become obese, this changes the processes by which the body uses food to make energy, build tissue, and remove waste material. Left untreated, these changes can lead to diabetes. Diabetes is a serious condition. It affects how your body uses blood sugar. Obese people also have higher rates of anxiety and depression than other individuals. Ronald Kahn studies diabetes at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts. He says researchers have wondered if people suffer from depression because they are obese or because of their metabolism. And we asked the question, maybe the metabolic link is at least partly fueled by the microbiome, Kahn said. The microbiome is the community of bacteria, fungi, and other microorganisms living in your stomach. It changes with your diet. And Kahn says those changes may affect both body and mind. To test the theory, he and his research team fed mice a high-fat diet and studied their behavior as the animals became obese. In one test, they put mice in a box divided into a darkened area on one side and a light area on the other side. They found that the more nervous, anxious mice liked to spend time on the dark side. And a mouse on a high-fat diet will spend more time in the dark than a mouse on a normal diet will. So, they have more signs of anxiety, Kahn said. The anxiety went away when the mice were given antibiotic drugs. The researchers said this suggests that the bacteria were helping make the mice nervous. The researchers then wanted to see if they could produce the same effect by giving the same bacteria to animals raised in a bacteria-free environment with no microbes of their own. They found that it did. Microbes from obese mice made the bacteria-free mice anxious. Microbes from obese mice given antibiotics did not. It was actually quite a surprise, Kahn said. Even though we had seen some effects on metabolism in the rest of the body, I was very surprised how dramatic and how clear the effects were also on the brain and on behavior. A report on the study appears in the journal Molecular Psychiatry. Kahn noted, however, that the new study does not mean antibiotics are the cure for depression. The drug kills both good and bad microbes. Also, drug misuse is making these powerful medicines less effective. Another important point, he said, is that what happens in mice does not necessarily happen in humans. I'm Phil Dierking.
Students at P.B. Smith Elementary School's Ecology Club are learning about the life and migration of monarch butterflies. They learn in the classroom about the butterfly's need for certain plants. They learn scientific words for the stages of a butterfly's life. But Ecology Club teacher Barbara Denny says they learn the most when they visit their school garden in Warrington, Virginia. There, they wait patiently for the monarch to arrive. Just recently, monarch butterflies landed in their garden, where, among vegetables and herbs, the students planted the milkweed plant. Monarchs lay their eggs on milkweed plants. There are concerns that the plants have been disappearing because of poor weather conditions and the use of herbicides. So monarchs, which travel between Canada and Mexico during their migration, now have far fewer places to stop. Denny explained to her students that planting the milkweed would create a station for the butterfly.
We talk about the need for a certain plant for an organism to survive. The big one is the milkweed. That is the host for the butterfly, the monarch specifically. And we've planted from seed milkweed plants.
10-year-old Keenan Whitney said he learned the importance of the cycles of nature.
I only thought they pollinated one flower for some reason, but then I learned that they pollinated a lot of flowers and that if we didn't have butterflies, we probably wouldn't have any food.
Students began to learn how to plant and harvest many herbs and vegetables when the Ecology Club started its vegetable garden a few years ago. They give some of the produce to their school cafeteria and the rest to a local food bank. Then Keely Scott, a high school student who once attended Smith Elementary, needed a Girl Scout project. She persuaded the school to add milkweed to the garden to attract butterflies.
And I loved looking at all the butterflies, and I was like, wow, well, we have a decreased population in our area. And I thought, oh, well, I can fix that. So I developed this idea, and Miss Denise supported me 100%.
11-year-old Amelia Jacob loves watching nature. She is excited about the daily discoveries.
We saw several swallowtails caterpillars, and there's this really fat one that should be turning into a chrysalis soon. I'm quite surprised at how it can turn into a chrysalis. And then just how does its body form into the beautiful body of a butterfly?
Denny says her mission is to teach children about the connection between humans and nature. When they understand this, she said, she has succeeded in her mission. I'm Susan Shand.
New technology is making it possible for people to make realistic videos of people appearing to say things they never actually said. The videos are known as deepfakes. The name comes from the process of deep learning, a form of artificial intelligence, or AI. They can be created with computer programs available for sale or on the internet. The technology uses face mapping and AI to produce false videos that look almost real. Lawmakers, intelligence officials, and media experts have expressed concern about deepfakes. They warn the false videos could be used to threaten America's national security or interfere in elections. The videos are created by loading a complex set of instructions into a computer, along with lots of images and audio recordings. The computer program then learns how to copy the person's facial expressions, movements, voice, and speaking patterns. Technical experts say, with enough video and audio of a person, the system can produce fake video of the person saying anything. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is one of several U.S. lawmakers warning of the dangers of such technology. He says that so far, deepfakes have mainly been used against famous people or to create humorous videos. But he says he can imagine foreign nations finding ways to use them to harm American democracy and society. Rubio told the Associated Press that a foreign intelligence service could use the technology. Such an actor could produce a fake video of a politician using racist language or doing something illegal. Or they could produce fake video of a U.S. soldier killing civilians overseas, or a foreign leader threatening nuclear war. It's a weapon that could be used, timed appropriately and placed appropriately, in the same way fake news is used, Rubio said. But in video form, such news could create distrust and chaos before an election or any other major U.S. decision, he added.
We know there are people out there that are trying to divide society, influence elections, and we know this capacity exists. So it's only logical that at some point someone's going to take the next step and sort of weaponize it.
The issue got attention earlier this year when the website BuzzFeed published a deepfake political video. The false video appeared to show former President Barack Obama giving an address that criticized President Donald Trump.
You see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would.
It was created using a combination of professional and free video editing programs using machine learning. Hani Farid is a digital forensics expert at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He agrees there is a great possibility that deepfakes will be used to try to influence America's politics. I expect that here in the United States, we will start to see this content in the upcoming midterms and national election, 2 years from now. The problem, Farid says, is that it will be very easy for almost anybody to create a realistic-looking fake video of world leaders. We have entered a new world where it is going to be difficult to know how to believe what we see, he told the Associated Press. He added that the opposite result is also worrying. People will become so used to seeing false videos that they will be more likely to doubt a real video. Farid expects the problem to spread worldwide. The U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is already working to develop technologies to identify fake images and videos. But Senator Rubio says currently the identification process is complex and takes a very long time.
It takes some real forensic technical capabilities to be able to show that it's not real. And by the time that's done, it's been widely disseminated.
Rubio and other lawmakers say people will need to take more responsibility to identify fakes. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed. But the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.